Back at it with you, fresh week, busy show on Monday, March 22nd, 2021, on Connecticut Today. We checked in with our old pal Mark Fitch from the Fitch Files at the Yankee Institute about our recent study showing how unionized Connecticut's governments really are. The governor, Ned Lamont, stepped up in the 4 o'clock hour to talk about the COVID situation and Connecticut's upcoming foray into legalized sports gambling. We talked with a Republican State House member from the eastern part of the state on the myriad of bills that would bigfoot local zoning regulations proposed by majority Democrats. And I also had some thoughts to kick off the show on the ongoing major problem at the U.S. southern border with Mexico. The former president giving his thoughts today on immigration. How about that? Boy, I tell you, we got some other stuff coming up today, but I got to tell you, is this not the biggest case of I told you so? I mean, this thing at the southern border is, look, you got to look at this as on a couple of angles here. Number one, you do have, for whatever reason, and these parents in Central America, Mexico, El Salvador, Chile, Guatemala, whatever, you know, they send their kids, for whatever reason, unaccompanied. No, they send them with some other adults, likely a human trafficker or something, over the border, and they figure that. And, you know, the federal government pretty much said over the weekend, well, yeah, you know, we send the adults back, but the kids stay. Well, geez. Isn't that exactly what the open borders crowd wants? And isn't that exactly what the human traffickers want? But this thing at the border, thousands of migrants just walking right across, claiming asylum. Everybody claims asylum. And I look, at the risk of sounding callous, look, folks, you know where I'm coming at on this. And they're, well, we're telling them not to come. Boy, I tell you, Einstein, Mr. President and Secretary Mayorkas, really, I'm just sure that the human traffickers, these people who collect money from desperate families, I'm sure, because you said not to come, oh, they're going to go not to come. No, because the Mayorkas guy said in the U.S. not to come. What a cluster. Oh, my God. You look at this. And DHS and border security, they're putting these miners in places that don't even have, by standards, drinkable water, I read over the weekend. And yet, for some reason, Psaki and Jen Psaki and all these other people in the White House Communications Department and Nancy Pelosi and all of her dopes, they all get up there and say, oh, it's Trump's. Well, you know, people were yearning to be free. So this is a result of a Trump White House. What? How stupid do you think we all are? You get three guesses and the first two don't count. Well, we're telling him not to come, really. And then, did you see this over the weekend? You probably did, because even the major networks, NBC, ABC, CBS, PBS, even the major networks picked up on this. They're saying, well, the kids can stay, right? But the adults got to go home, which is exactly what the traffickers want. Well, the kids are there, so they're going to have to eventually let the parents in. Don't you think they're thinking that? And then, did you see they're going to fly some of these migrants? They're going to fly them to get processed at the Canadian border, the northern U.S. border with Canada. Are you kidding me? And then they're going to spend, they already admitted spending, they've taken out $90 million of, you ready for this, hotel rooms. To put these people in hotel rooms. They're going to fly them a couple of thousand miles north to the U.S.-Canadian border. Are you kidding me? This has to be a joke. Is this the Onion? Is this the Babylon Bee? Did Mad Magazine come back? Unbelievable. And Mayorkas and Jen Psaki and Nancy Pelosi, they're all saying, well, there's not really a problem there. Meantime, you've got some other Democrats saying, well, you know, Dick Durbin over the weekend was saying, well, the White House really has to come out with a definitive a definitive plan, you know, for this whole thing, a policy. And that's the point, folks. I read a really interesting summary of all this in the Washington Post over the weekend. And I forgot who said it because I read dozens of stuff over the weekend, dozens of things. Somebody said in the Washington Post, and I'm kind of paraphrasing here, but somebody said this about this problem. This person or whomever this columnist was said, listen, the Biden White House coming in, they knew with this, you know, after they had telegraphed during the campaign, pretty much what's happening now. After they pretty much said, hey, whatever Trump did, we're going to reverse it. If Trump did up, we're going to do down. If Trump did black, we're going to do white. If Trump did right, we're going to do left. This person in the Washington Post said, well, after you transmit this or broadcast this for a year, you had better have a policy ready from day one to deal with this because you've got a choice. You can either, it's one of two P's in the alphabet. It's policy or pandering. One of the two. And I read this. I said, boy, that if that doesn't distill this whole thing down to a simple notion here, it's policy or pandering. That's it. Do you have a constructive policy? Do you have anything in place to deal with this from a logistical standpoint, from a legislative standpoint, from a standpoint of food and water and transportation? Or are you just pandering, which apparently they are, to the far left nutcases in the party who want to see the U.S. border violated because they're just not into U.S. sovereignty anymore? Part of the Democratic Party is not into U.S. sovereignty. That's why when anybody talks about border security, I even heard a couple of Democrats today say, well, you know, we need higher security. We need the walls to be fortified. Oh, my God. When I heard the walls or the barriers to be fortified, I almost fell off my chair. See, because they're kind of going, oh, boy, this is not good. But there's a certain element of the Democratic Party that wants to chip away a little at U.S. sovereignty. And again, I'll ask it over and over and over again till I get a straight answer. Where else is this allowed in the world where a sovereign country simply has to just let people in because they claim asylum? When we know we've got border security professionals, we've got DHS professionals who tell the politicians, here is what is happening. Here is what is happening. Don't drown me in your political speak now, because this is what's happening. And they go, well, you know, it's just these people want a better life. Oh, stop that. It's mind-numbing to see what's going on. You've got a president who at best can say, well, don't come here. You've got Mayorkas there saying, well, we're trying. We're coming up with stuff. You didn't see this coming. No, you did see it coming. And the bottom line is you're okay with this. The bottom line is you're okay with this. And just think a few months ago, and listen, the president got beat, Donald Trump got beat in the election, that's fine, the people spoke, move on. Why wasn't this really happening to this extent? Because, geez, he had a working agreement with, I don't know, the president of Mexico. The third safe country agreement, they had to wait in Mexico or another country to see if their asylum cases were going to get taken. The fact that President Lopez Obrador at one time had stationed troops on the approach to the U.S. border, and these troops, a lot of them said, hey, turn around, you're not being let in. But folks, what I saw this weekend is mind-numbing. And when they get up there, when Democrats get up there and they tell you, well, we told them not to come, or we're begging them not to come, and they're a little put off or a little unexpected, shall we say. They're, you know, they were not expecting this flow. Are you kidding me? Come on. Please. Talk to them a lot about what's going on in Hartford and what's going on with the Yankee Institute of Public Policy for all of us evil right-wingers in the state who expect, you know, balanced books and common sense social policy. Mark Fitch joins us once again. He writes the Fitch Files column for the Yankee Institute. Mark, it's Paul here. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well, Paul. Thanks for having me on.
Mark, it's a pleasure all the time. We need somebody to keep us updated on what the current level of lunacy is, the lunacy meter here. Mark, we need you to help us with that. First of all, before we get on to what's going on to the General Assembly now and all these public hearings every day, multiple ones, you noted an interesting report the other day on union influence in Connecticut. And it's not as if we didn't know that existed, but I was still surprised by a couple of things you wrote in that piece.
Yeah, so basically, according to a website called unionstats.com, which is run by a couple professors since about 2002, they use Census Bureau data to compile statistics about labor unions in the United States. And it found that Connecticut has the most unionized government workforce in the country. So and that includes state and local. So, you know, you're talking municipal workers, teachers, all the way up to state employees. And we have nearly, our public sector is nearly 75% of workers in our public sector are union members. And that beat out even the state of New York by about 4 percentage points, you know, making us the most unionized, you know, government sector in the nation.
And it's interesting. I always find that interesting, Mark, because we're a relatively small state, what, 3.5 million people, 3.6, whatever, and you can take the, I don't know, 40,000, whatever it is, 35, 40,000, for example, state employees, and even if you say, well, okay, 35,000 or 40,000 translates to, you know, one other Democratic vote in the household to 70 or 80,000 or even more. That's a lot of votes, Mark, in a relatively small state. And, you know, that clump of power can really swing elections. And it does.
It absolutely does. They have a strong base of, you know, people that they can, you know, the union leaders can contact their members. They don't have to, they can encourage them to vote for particular candidates without having to disclose any political spending, anything like that. So, you know, especially when you think of Connecticut AFL-CIO, I think they claim about 260,000 members just alone, just themselves.
Yeah.
So that's a sizable, you know, chunk of the population and, you know, a fairly politically motivated chunk of the population because when you start talking about, you know, state and local employees, their pay, their conditions of employment are largely determined by collective bargaining agreements. Mm-hmm. So if you get the right people into the negotiating seat on the state or municipal side, you can do a lot better for yourself. You know, if you have a sympathetic governor, somebody you helped get elected, and they're in charge of negotiating with you, you can work out a pretty cozy deal. And this has pretty large implications for the upcoming year. Governor Lamont his administration is currently in contract negotiations with the state employee labor unions to renew their contracts. And what that's going to look like, what kind of concessions he might be looking for, whether or not he'll be able to get them, all that you know plays into the power politics here.
Yeah, Mark, hang on. Mark, yes. Do me a favor. Hang on. I want to get into that because that was my next line of questioning here because, you know, I don't think it's any surprise. You and I see these headlines almost every day in various publications. You know, the far left of the Democratic Party, they're not exactly enamored with Governor Lamont. So we'll talk about that. Mark Fitch from the Yankee Institute is on the line with us. More with Mark. Traffic and weather together, 3:36 on WICC. And we are at 3:39:21 before the top of the hour, 4 o'clock network news. Then the latest from Governor Ned Lamont. Mark Fitch is with us from the Yankee Institute. For public policy, yankeeinstitute.org. Check him out. Mark writes the Fitch Files column, also keeps an eye on what's going on in the General Assembly. And Mark, you touched on something that, yeah, it's could come to a head by this summer, around July 1 or August 1 or so. Listen, you and I both know, Mark, that on a lot of issues, including this, the labor negotiations with the thousands of state employees, Governor Ned Lamont is not seen as some saving angel here. He's viewed by a lot of people in the Democratic Party, even though he does have pretty good, you know, approval ratings, largely because of COVID-19. And he's not Dan Malloy, so I always say give him some points for that. You like that, huh? You know, he gets points.
That's true.
Well, yeah. And the guy's at 60-something percent. But, you know, the far left, the labor part of the Democratic Party, there's no real love affair here with this guy.
No, there isn't. One of the things in his proposed budget was he wanted to eliminate another general wage increase for state employees. And the state employee union came out and basically said, no, we're not having that. We want another raise. You know, they just got two in a row. And secondly, he has pretty much said he's not willing to raise taxes, particularly on the wealthy. There's a bevy of taxes, tax proposals that have come out and are being debated in the legislature right now. Everything ranging from a tax on quote-unquote mansions, which is any house assessed at $330,000 or above, to raising the top income tax bracket rate, to taxing increasing the capital gains tax. All these different things are coming out from the labor unions and the organizations they support, and they're very good at rallying the troops and getting them to these public hearings to support these measures. But Governor Lamont, you know, has so far said, no, we don't need to do that. I'm not willing to do that at this point. And yeah, there is not really a love affair here. And, you know, by and large, you know, the labor unions, you know, massively supported his, you know, gubernatorial efforts. But
yeah,
at this point, I think they're a little frustrated with his refusal to increase taxes and his, you know, push to actually, you know, he's really pushing to bring more technology to the state so that we don't have to hire a lot more employees. We're looking at a big retirement cliff coming soon where we're looking at a lot of state employee retirements. And rather than rehire those same positions, the Lamont administration is looking to consolidate agencies and positions using, you know, updated technology and software. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't have the state employee unions very happy either. I mean, they want more employees to get more dues to, you know, continue their influence.
So what happens here, Mark, in a couple of months, and that's it, you just put that marvelously, is going to be my next point here. What happens in a couple of months if this thing comes to a loggerhead and the governor says, well, no, there are going to be these retirements, and I'm sorry, we are going to initiate, you know, contracts with these companies to, you know, streamline and come into the year 2021 or 22 like some other states do. What if the governor, or can he, Mark, say to the state unions, here's how many jobs I'm budgeting, take it or leave it?
Well, I mean, that all gets, you know, hashed out in the contract negotiations, which are private. We don't have access to that. We only get to see the finished product that they come out with that the legislature then gets to vote on. So we don't know how that's going to play out. And, you know, the labor unions have been very vocal saying, you know, calling Lamont's budget an austerity budget and things of that nature, when it's really not the case. We have $3 billion in our reserve fund. We have apparently billions coming from the federal government. So saying that it's an austerity budget and trying to push for higher taxes at this point seems more like it doesn't have to do with the budget per se, as it has to do with never letting a crisis go to waste, in this case, the COVID crisis, and saying, well, because we've had COVID, we need to raise taxes on this particular group of people.
It doesn't make any sense. I mean, to the common person, Mark, like you and I, who are figuring out how to pay the light bill, it does ring hollow with a lot of people. Now, the operative question is here, well, can Lamont be defeated? Do people want him defeated? I found it interesting, Mark, a couple of weeks ago, on the Republican side, Erin Stewart said she's not running. So she made a very quick weekend announcement, I'm not running. So everybody, including myself and a lot of the political operatives in the state, were saying, okay, looks like this is Stefanowski against Themis Claridis for the GOP nomination in a few months. What do you think on that? What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, I agree with your assessment of Erin Stewart. I think she probably looked at the fact that she also has a challenger in for mayor of New Britain. And also, Lamont is still riding high in poll numbers, and, you know, his response to the COVID crisis has been largely popular, apparently, you know, among when you look at the polls. So you'd be coming in, you know, a couple steps behind. Now, Stefanowski, on the other hand, has never actually left the public sphere. He's been out there in the press, in the media, essentially campaigning since 2018.
Yeah.
So, and he's got his own group of followers. So, yeah, I think that will probably be the case. You know, as far as Themis, we haven't heard too much from her yet.
Yeah.
But she might just be biding her time and waiting to see how, you know, waiting to read the tea leaves when it gets a little closer to election time.
So we could have another battle of two rich guys again, all over the all over, right? I mean, how these things come around, but, you know, right? It looks that way.
Yeah, that would be the case. And, you know, the unions got behind Lamont before. We'll see how their loyalties lie, and, you know, they're never above running a third party candidate or somebody to try to primary. So,
yeah, you know, Mark, I was talking about this with some of my contacts up at the Capitol the other day. I said, and I asked two different contacts. I said, do you think it's crazy that if this tension continues with Lamont, if he digs in and says, listen, no, I know a lot of these rich people, they're friends of mine, we're not going to raise their taxes because they can go to Florida or go to South Carolina, whatever. If he digs his heels in on that, Mark, if he digs his heels in on the union negotiations, could he get a primary challenge from the left of the party? I asked a couple of people in Hartford, and they said not out of the question in any way.
It's not out of the question. I think it would probably split the vote, though, and it could be that could hurt the Democrats' chances at retaining the governorship. So it just depends on how far they want to take it.
Yeah, that's true.
It also depends on how dug in, you know, Lamont is. I mean, he's obviously tried to, you know, push the labor unions in the past. You know, tried to suspend the last round of state employee raises when everybody was out of work and they were getting raises, but they weren't willing to play ball, you know. So it depends on how much how far he's willing to go with those negotiations. We'll see.
Certainly. Always good to hear from you, Mark Fitch. Folks, check out his Fitch Files. Just Google that, Fitch Files, Mark, M-A-R-C, Fitch, F-I-T-C-H, Yankee Institute for Public Policy, yankeeinstitute.org. Mark, thank you. Always good to speak with you. Take care, and we'll talk down the road. Thanks.
Thank you, Paul. Anytime.
All right, Mark Fitch there, folks. Fitch Files, and he keeps an eye on what's going on in Hartford, one of the great micro sites around the area that I always refer to, the yankeeinstitute.org.
Hospitalizations and fatalities, the key metric that we've been focused on, especially in this time of vaccination. Where are we on the vaccine update? Over half of our folks, 45 and above, have now been vaccinated, at least had their first dose. 75 and above is almost 80%. I think you can see 36% of all adults over the age of 16 have received their first dose, 36%. And we figure, like I said, during the early days, we had a lot of people get infected on top of the, 300,000 cases we know. So there's a lot of folks who have some sort of antibody built-in immunity. So that gives us a little bit of protection over and above the percentage of people who have been vaccinated. It's like a natural governor to what's going on, unlike this guy. And I think that's going to make a difference going forward, and that's why our trend lines continue downward on all the key metrics that make a difference. And that's why we have 45 and above has been open. We had, I think it was 80,000 appointments made since Friday morning. 22% of all the people of 45 and 54 have already been vaccinated their first shot. I said, Josh, that seems like an awful lot in a short period of time. He reminded me a lot of them were healthcare workers, educators, and daycare. So they were already in the process of being vaccinated. And that's what we assumed in our budgeting. I think it's worth noting on the next track, we opened up a little bit differently to vaccinations than other states. We did it in a very methodical way, age-based, narrowed the aperture, so you didn't open it up to everybody first come, first serve. AP wrote an article recently saying, of those states that opened up too widely, too fast, where you had websites crashing, people waiting in lines, nothing there, like South Carolina and Florida, they ended up having a lower percentage of their people ended up getting vaccinated than states like Hawaii and Connecticut and some others that were more focused narrowly in terms of opening it up on a methodical basis. And it's also worth remembering that states like Hawaii and Connecticut, which are more age-based, a lot higher percentage of our elderly are vaccinated, unlike some states like South Carolina and Florida, where it's a little more first come, first serve, some they skew younger. So that's made a big difference for us in terms of, again, fatalities and hospitalizations, and that's made a difference, as this next graph will tell you. This is a headline in the Hartford Courant, I think just a few days ago. Seniors seen the biggest drops in fatalities and deaths. That's the red line, 80 and above. Same thing as we saw in our nursing homes. It reminds you the vaccines work and the vaccines are safe and they're making an enormous difference, which is why we were able to continue opening cautiously with 100% occupancy last Friday. That said, we have to continue our outreach, especially for black and brown populations. We have some of our towns where you have, 70% of the eligible population has been vaccinated, and some of our cities where it's more like 35 or 40. So we've got to do a better job of getting people vaccinated there. And this is just something we're rolling out now. It's the mobile vaccination vans. We have 35 of them scaling up. We'll have them end of this month and really in April when we get all the vaccines, the widest supply. At the same time, we'll be opened up to everybody without age group on April 5th. These vans will be able to do 160 doses a day. They'll be in the church parking lot at the end of the service. They'll be in other congregate settings, housing. So we're taking the vaccine to you to do everything we can to expand our reach. Susan and I have been to a lot of facilities where we're making calls, dialing out, guiding people to come to get vaccination. And those are part of the equity programs that we're going to be rolling up and ramping up. We've got in our most socially disadvantaged, vulnerable communities that represent about 25% of our population. 22% of those people have been vaccinated, not quite where we wanted to be. We want to at least be at the state normal or better. So we've got a little ways to go, but we are making progress there. I think, let me just change gear. It was a pretty big week last week. For the last many, many years, Connecticut has been trying to reach an agreement with our tribal partners, Mohegan Sun and Foxwoods, in order to bring our gaming into the 21st century. And if we've learned one thing after a year of COVID is how much of the world is moving into a virtual world. We've seen that in telehealth. We've seen that in teleeducation. We've seen that in telecommuting. And it was really important both to the state of Connecticut and our tribal partners that we get this right. And we worked hard, David and Melissa and Paul and our team, negotiating this. A lot of people said, just do a deal, just make a deal. We wanted a deal that was in the best interests of, all three partners, best interests of the taxpayers of the state of Connecticut. And it's sort of three pieces. One, it allows us to get into sports betting. You've seen what they're doing in New Jersey and New Hampshire and a few other states. We're ahead of the curve there. That's going to be available both to our tribal partners as well as to the Connecticut Lottery Corporation. That was important. Because that means allows us to expand and compete there as well. Online casino gaming, that's an extension of the compact. The tribes have the exclusive to do casino gaming in real time. Now they also have the exclusive to do real online casino gaming in the virtual world. We get a revenue share of 18 going up to 20% after year five. That's going to represent significant resources for the state and to our tribal partners, probably north of $100 million in net cash flow to each of our tribal partners and eventually to the state as well over a period of time. And Rob and his team at the Lottery Corporation have the right to move from paper to iLottery and draw games at casino. And that's important. I mean, right now, that business, you know, I didn't focus on it, is a billion-dollar business with about $400 million a year in revenue to the state of Connecticut, which allows us to hold down taxes and invest in key services. So the fact that we'll be able to expand this over a period of time and compete, I think, is an important plus for across the state. We wouldn't be able to do it if we didn't have the right team who were able to take the lead there. I know a lot of people have been, you know, worrying about some of the quasis and the folks who are leading that. And we had some problems in the corporation lottery going back a few years. We've got a good team. We've got a good team right now. Greg Smith, he's the executive director. Greg has been executive director at other states. He's a really good person to help take the Lottery Corporation, you know, to the next level in terms of the virtual space and in terms of sports. And in particular, my friend Rob Simulclair, who's been chairman there. You know, Rob has experience at, I think it's ESPN, NBC Sports, a lot of experience in digital media. So I think he's ideally suited to take this major endeavor from the state and bring it into the modern era. Rob, you want to tell us a little bit about what this agreement means to the Lottery Commission, what we can expect to see and when?
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Governor Lamont. I appreciate it. I know when you and I first talked about this role at Lottery, this was really the vision that we had when we first sat down to talk about the chairmanship of this board. And so I want to thank you and your team for the hard work that you put in. You know, this was an agreement that a lot of people didn't think would necessarily happen anytime soon. There had been challenges getting an agreement done. But, you know, thanks to your leadership, the leadership of Lieutenant Governor Bicewicz, and then I have to acknowledge the great work of your staff, of Secretary McCaw, of Commissioner David Lehman, who just did a tremendous job in negotiating with our tribal partners, as well as your chief of staff, Mr. Mounts, who's on this call. So I want to recognize everyone on your team for the great work that was done. You know, this agreement between the state and our tribal nations really is it's a once-in-a-generation pact. It sets our state up to be regionally competitive in this fast-growing marketplace of gaming and sports betting that was previously unregulated. Connecticut Lottery's piece of the agreement really has three main elements. First is the ability to sell existing lottery products online, such as draw tickets, things like Mega Millions and Powerball, our daily numbers games. We'll be able to sell that online through you know, mobile apps and other cashless options for people who like to play those games. Secondly, we'll be able to operate one of the three online sports betting platforms that has been authorized by this deal, with the tribal nations operating the other two. And then third, the ability to launch up to 15 retail sports betting locations. So bricks and mortar sports books that will be able to stand up around the state. We're particularly excited about this retail opportunity, as we feel it has the potential to create great new entertainment zones and hubs, as well as jobs, especially in Hartford and Bridgeport, where we plan to really focus on creating a significant presence. Governor, this announcement also is really, as you know, just the beginning of this process. There still needs to be legislation drafted and passed. I know that your team is already getting to work on drafting legislation, and we're hopeful that the legislature will move quickly on that, as time is of the essence here as we try to get to market with these products. The tribal compacts will need to be amended, and those amendments will need to be approved by the Federal Department of the Interior. And then, of course, the state will have to create regulations around this. So we'll have to identify what the regulatory body will be that will regulate this new gaming in our state, and what those regulations will be. So that all needs to happen before we can actually start taking bets. And that's not going to happen overnight, but we're feeling confident now that we've cleared this really big hurdle of an agreement with the tribes. Of course, you know, with additional gaming options in the state, we firmly believe, as I know you do, Governor Lamont, that there needs to be additional resources to assist the small percentage of people who will struggle with problem gambling. You know, we know that it's a very small percentage, and our current lottery setup that have struggles with problem gaming, and we want to make sure that we have the resources available to them. We're already in conversations with the Connecticut Council on Problem Gambling about what resources they think they'll need in this new landscape, this digital landscape. And you know, I think the good news is that the online nature of a lot of these new gaming options actually make it easier to both identify and to help people who run into trouble. It's much easier to do that in a digital landscape than it is in an all-cash business. We'll know our customers better. We'll have a better sense of who's having trouble and the ability to help them deal with and get any resources they need to help with any problem gambling. The last thing I want to say is that, you know, Connecticut Lottery's inclusion in this framework is really great news for Connecticut taxpayers. Over the last 5 years alone, the Connecticut Lottery has returned more than $1.7 billion to the state's general fund. That includes just over $304 million that we've already contributed to the general fund in the current fiscal year. That was almost after almost $350 million that we contributed last year. We're well ahead of that pace. We're looking to get to about $400 million this year if we continue on the current pace. And we've generated all of that through brick and mortar establishments, cash purchases alone, our traditional scratch tickets and draw games. So now with our state on the precipice of authorizing online lottery purchases and sports betting, you know, with this new agreement, we really think that this is going to enable Connecticut Lottery to significantly grow our contributions to the state.
All right. Well said, Rob. Any questions?
Channel 3 Eyewitness News.
Yes, Governor. First, a question about the coronavirus. You know, we just wanted to know if we know what percentage of our infections are from the variants right now.
I certainly heard in New York it could be up to 50%. I don't think we really know. We're not really doing as much that genetic sequences as we could. Josh, anything else to add on that?
Well, we're working a lot with our colleagues at the Yale School of Public Health, and they're doing a lot of sequencing and doing a lot of analysis. They estimate we're probably in the range of 30 to 40% of the cases in the state right now are the B117 variant, but it is an estimate at this point.
Are we specifically doing any testing on the New York variant 1526, and do we have any preliminary numbers from that sequencing?
Yeah, I think they are starting to look for that now, and we don't have any cases identified at this point.
All right, and my final question, this one will be about sports wagering. You know, we have the March Madness tournament happening right now, and I just wanted to know how we might be navigating the collegiate aspect of all of this. You know, for example, New Jersey and Rhode Island, they prohibit wagers being placed on their college teams. So we just wanted to see how Connecticut might go down that path.
Want to take that, Rob?
Yes, thank you for that question. That is an open question right now in Connecticut. As you mentioned, different states have taken different approaches. Some states do not allow college betting at all. Some prohibit it on the colleges that are in their state. Some only prohibit it on the colleges that are in their state when those teams are playing at home. We don't know yet exactly what we're going to do. That's going to be an open question for the regulation process and the legislation and the regulations that are drafted. So we don't know yet, but you know, we're certainly going to be keen to follow whatever regulations are passed.
Thank you very much.
News 8.
Good afternoon. First for Josh, you were quoted when it comes to some of the more vulnerable population of making progress, not quite there. Kind of a two-part. Once we get all the mobile units out there, will people have, as Hartford Healthcare and Yale is doing, allowing people to choose the vaccine? Will people have that choice? And once all those mobile units are out there, do you expect to see a bigger rise in those people getting vaccinated?
Sure. Well, a couple of things. First of all, people have the choice today in terms of which vaccine. It's made visible in the reservation process and at walk-up clinics which vaccine's being administered. But with regards to the mobile units, keep in mind, this is just one more additional set of resources we're adding. We already have a number of our providers doing We estimate over 1,000 mobile clinics around the state already. That's at churches, that's at senior housing complexes. So this is going to be another fleet of resources that we can deploy very quickly and flexibly, in the next month and a half to help address the remaining kind of prioritized populations. By the time we get to the late spring, the summer, we're going to have more vaccine than we're going to have people who want to take it. So we envision these mobile units operating almost on an ice cream truck model, where you can drive through neighborhoods and you can flag them down and get a vaccination, or they can go park at a popular, a food truck or a festival. So we're just going to try. We're anticipating a future, and then very soon, where everyone who wants a vaccine has already gotten one, and now we have to make it as absolutely easy as we possibly can for everyone else to get vaccinated. We're going to, as the governor mentioned, we're going to have additional supports for local communities that we'll be announcing as well. This is a community-led effort, and so many of our communities have already done a fantastic job of doing outbound calling, doing walk-up clinics, doing door-to-door canvassing. And so we're going to be providing more resources through our Department of Public Health to help further ramp up those efforts.
And for the governor, earlier in the month, you said that Connecticut has earned the ability to roll back capacity and so on and so forth. Today, Rochelle Walensky indicated that she has concerns about the states that maybe the numbers didn't indicate that, but still opened things up a little bit too soon. If the numbers do go up at all, do you have a point where relative to what she said, where you would think that, well, maybe if we hit 4 or 5% or 6%, we're going to need to rethink this?
Yeah, I think she was really concerned about those states like Texas that have an infection rate that's much higher than ours, opened everything up, and then sort of dismissed wearing the mask and social distancing. That's not Connecticut. We've kept our capacity very low, and we're wearing the mask. So I think that was the bigger issue there. And as I've said before, I'm a little less focused on the positivity rate, a lot more focused in terms of, in particular, hospitalizations, making sure we continue to have capacity there, making sure our strategy is working, which is vaccinate those who are most vulnerable, make sure they don't have to be hospitalized, make sure we keep our fatalities at a minimum. And so far, I think it's working pretty well.
And yes, there were more public hearing today, another public hearing. And these things are coming fast and furiously on a bunch of bills. And folks, I started warning you about this last year when I first started reading this, the Democratic majority trying to assert whatever pressure it can. Is this on the governor? I don't know. But spotlighting affluent areas of the state they think are not doing enough for affordable housing. There was a bill today, SB 1068, that would basically, folks, levy an additional property tax, ding, 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 on some homes located in cities and towns which don't meet a 10% requirement on affordable housing. So, again, this is an effort by Hartford to, hopefully not, but to Bigfoot maybe some local zoning laws. And joining us right now to talk about this and whether any of these laws really have any chance or not, State Rep. Holly Cheeseman is on the line, 37th Assembly District, Republican, representing residents in the eastern part of the state, East Lyme and Salem as well. Holly, hi, it's Paul at WICC. How are you today?
I'm well, Paul. How are you?
I'm good, Holly, but it's like, you need a scorecard, Holly, with all these bills
Absolutely.
I counted the other day, Holly, I think there's something like 6 or 8 of these bills that in some way, shape, or form are threatening local control over zoning laws from the state. What is the latest on all this?
Well, of course, the one you're referencing, I think it's 1068, which is in planning and development. We saw something very similar in finance. Yes, there is a real drive, one, both to take local zoning away from local communities, but also to, in effect, punish, quote unquote, communities who don't, as you mentioned, have enough affordable housing. And we had a lot of testimony in finance, and this basically, depending on what percentage of affordable housing you had, the less you had, the more the punitive, the extra levy would be. Governor Lamont has made it clear he is not in favor of tax increases. So from that point of view, this doesn't have legs. But on the other hand, when you look at the whole question of affordable housing, the way we define it is crazy. That no building built before 1990 can be considered. So that limits the amount of housing stock that could be considered affordable. So a developer comes in, I'm going to build 30% affordable housing units in this 600, apartment complex. Yeah. All of a sudden, you've got, maybe 200 affordable housing units, but you've added another 400. You're never going to hit that 10%. So it actively works against, I think, really building affordable housing by that, nothing built before 1990, and encourage towns to do it the right way. I mean, I think accessory, if you want to rent out an apartment, sure. If you want to build mixed development here in East Lyme, we've done a lot with commercial on the ground floor and market rate apartments on the top floor. Mm-hmm. But leave it up to the local communities. And certainly some rural towns, hitting that 10% is going to be virtually impossible because they don't have the sewer infrastructure.
Yeah, Holly, and one thing that drives me crazy about this, and I'm sure you and your legislators on both sides of the aisle must have think about this. Look, it's always, the argument is always, well, maybe somebody who grew up in Hartford and had it tough, they want to live in a suburban apartment, or somebody wants to get out of New Haven or get out of Bridgeport to go to Lower Fairfield County, whatever, or out of the Eastern, out of New London to go to Niantic or those areas. Well,
right.
How about when these developers, Holly, come into these cities and you see all about, the mayors always crow about, look at this great apartment building in Bridgeport or Hartford or New Haven. And then you go online and you look at what some of these rents cost. And I'm like, well, who right now is on the margins in this city can live, in a building, for example? Some of these buildings are wonderful. They have great amenities. And a studio is like $1,800 a month. Who can afford that?
No, absolutely. Well, I think it's the dichotomy we see. And to be honest, if you really want to have those affordable housing developments, then work with the communities. Come up with a way to do it. Everybody wants a community in which people can afford to live, whether it's teachers and firemen, whether it's people, they want the school system or whatever. But I don't think you achieve that by punitive measures like, oh, we're going to add something to your mill rate, and have the state then decide how it's going to be spent. Are you really going to send it to Hartford and New Haven and Bridgeport? Is that actually going to be spent on, creating better affordable housing there or whatever? There's such a lack of trust in this state, Paul.
Holly, you're right.
The government takes your money, and who knows what they're going to do with it. I mean, our taxpayers have been promised so many times this is going to fix it, and it never does.
Well, what is it, Holly? It's been, five or six years? Folks forget, and I remind them about this, in one of former Governor Malloy's tax packages. You remember when the cities and towns and municipalities were supposedly, I believe, Holly, earmarked to get a percentage of an increase on the sales tax, and that hasn't even happened yet. It hasn't happened.
The Municipal Revenue Sharing Account, MRSA. Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
That hasn't happened. That teachers were going to get 100%, tax relief on their pensions. Well, that's been postponed. So, you name it. Lottery was going to fix education. The income tax was going to fix everything. Time after time after time, Connecticut reaches into the pockets of a citizen saying this is going to be the answer, and it never is.
And, I had a boss in radio once who's still a good friend of mine, Holly, who said the minute we lose our credibility, if we do something dumb on the air and we lose our credibility, it takes us tenfold of an effort to get that back. And, Holly, I know there are fine men and women on both sides of the aisle of you folks in Hartford of the General Assembly. They're toiling away to try and run this state with all good intentions. But like you said, when promises are consistently not kept, most people I know say the heck with all of them. And that's not right. It's not.
Well, exactly. I mean, even Governor Lamont promised I'm going to restore the property tax credit as part of his campaign. Once Stefanowski came out and said, well, I'm going to get rid of the income tax, I think Governor Lamont felt, well, I have to have some offer. Have we had the $500 property tax credit restored? I don't think so.
Yeah.
No, it's well, as I said on the floor, you know, Connecticut risks becoming not the land of steady habits, but the land of broken promises. And I think that people who live in the state have come to the sad conclusion that it probably is.
And to think, Holly, if you go on YouTube and you look at these old travel reels and old real estate pitches, Connecticut, you know, not that long ago was considered a tax haven. It's just it's so amazing to look at.
I know, our transformation, and you know, some of the bills we saw in finance would put our top marginal tax rate even above New Jersey and New York, which are pretty crazy.
No,
you'd be
yeah.
close to 14%. So, yeah.
It's lunacy.
Yeah. You know what? We yep. need to be good stewards of taxpayers' dollars mm-hmm. and have some real fiscal discipline, which are actually bipartisan budgets started, but that's when the numbers were almost tied in the House and tied in the Senate, so.
That's right. You're talking a couple of
real changes made. Yeah.
Yeah. A couple of cycles ago when it was 18, and there was some fiscal sanity for a couple of years. Holly, thank you. State Rep. Holly Cheesman, Republican 37th Assembly District. Holly, thanks. And we'll talk down the road. We appreciate the time today.
All right. Terrific. Thanks so much, Paul. Enjoy the sunshine.
You too, Holly. Thank you. Holly Cheesman, 37th Assembly District. She represents the eastern part of the state, East Lyme and Salem. There you go. All good points. All good points. There you go. And yes, there was starting to actually be some fiscal sanity when the state Senate was 18-18. And they actually worked together. But then what happened? Oh, we got to show Trump. That's right. All you people who voted Republicans out of the state Senate for no good reason. Then, oh, we got to get back at Trump. Well, how's that been? Well, let's see. I hate Trump. I really hate Trump and the Republicans, so I'm going to vote to tax me even more. See that? See how I did that? I hate Trump. So, raise my taxes, okay? Okay?